The following interview was recorded for CFRO The Pulse, Vancouver Co-op Radio's daily news show. The Pulse airs Monday to Friday at 7 a.m. on 100.5 FM and streaming live at cooperadio.org.
Well, as the opioid crisis continues to worsen with rising numbers of monthly deaths, now above six deaths per day in the province, and the COVID-19 crisis being blamed largely for the sudden increase after years of slight improvements, many have called for an urgent, safe supply to be provided of drugs, not simply prescription analogs as was created temporarily during the pandemic, but for the long term and of the drugs people actually use. One of those in particular is heroin, but it is difficult to produce that in the province. And the former provincial health officer, Dr. Perry Kendall, is now involved in a company, Fair Price Pharma, that is hoping to get approved to mass-produce prescription-safe heroin. He's also the co-interim acting executive director of the BC Centre on Substance Use, and he was the provincial health officer until Dr. Bonnie Henry replaced him in 2018. Dr. Kendall, thank you so much for joining us here on The Pulse on CFRO and Vancouver Co-op Radio.
Oh, you're welcome.
Dr. Kendall, the last time that you and I talked was quite a while ago, back in 2016, when I was still at Metro News, and we were at the very beginning of what became the overdose emergency at that time. I wanted to kind of, looking back in a broad picture over the last 4 years, what's your takeaway in terms of how far we've come and how far we have to go?
That's a good question. We have clearly seen a lot of responses, I mean, across British Columbia in a lot of areas. And in 2019, we did see declines in mortality from overdose-related deaths, about a 30% decline on average over that year. And going into 2020, January, February, well, good months as well in terms of maintaining the low level of overdose deaths. There was concern, however, that while overdoses were being reversed, the number of overdoses and the severity of overdoses was still staying very high. The emergency response services were seeing just as many. And the severity of the overdoses was high as well. So although people were recovering, we were worried about gradually increasing amounts of anoxic brain damage in those individuals. Then what happened in March, as you'll be aware, is COVID struck, and a lot of the services that had been put in place were reduced in volume. Access was reduced due to social distancing, and some services actually closed down because of the concerns over risk of infection to healthcare workers. That, coupled with what we think was a change in the toxic drug supply, particularly fentanyl, resulted in a major upwelling of mortality, so that we saw numbers in the monthly tallies of 170 or 180, numbers that were higher than anything we'd seen in prior years.
I mean, this is over five deaths a day in the province. That's a shocking number.
That's correct.
I mean, we've been covering the safe supply guidelines that came out as a result of COVID. I wondered if you could tell me a little bit about, you know, your role or thoughts about those and how well that they were rolled out, in your opinion.
From a public health perspective, the cause of the overdose deaths is clearly people using very toxic street drugs. In theory, if you can get people away from that supply, either into a withdrawal management and recovery program or into a maintenance program on methadone or buprenorphine and suboxone or even heroin for people who that doesn't work, you're replacing the toxic drug supply with a safer drug supply in a therapeutic relationship. But there are a lot of people who don't actually meet the medical criteria for an opioid substance use disorder, but who are still exposed to toxic drugs. And there's the fact that a lot of these people who are using opioids, illicit opioids, are also using other drugs, alcohol, stimulants, etc. So from a public health perspective, if you want to stop people dying and you've gone as far as you can with recovery or maintenance programs, then the attempt to provide people with a safer, pharmaceutically guaranteed supply is one approach, a harm reduction approach that should save lives if you can get the drugs out there. So that's the theory behind safe supply.
And you're involved in the BC Center for Substance Use now, so you have had a frontline seat in this whole thing.
Yeah, I'm part-time executive co-director in the interim while we're waiting to appoint a new director.
But you have had a front seat to this.
Sort of, yes. Certainly I've been at tables where this is discussed, yes. And the BCCSU was the agency that, with frontline clinicians with addiction specialty and with people with lived experience, developed the guidelines when this program, the risk mitigation, risk management program, was announced in March.
One of the things that we heard back then was that it was primarily analog drugs that people could use, like Dilaudid, instead of heroin. And there was concerns from drug users that drugs most commonly used were not included on the list. And it was because of the lack of the ability to produce them, I understood. Is that correct?
There is no domestic manufacturer for diacetylmorphine, which is heroin. So although that drug has been available for some years, it's been available in limited quantities in very very observed. It's people have to be watched while they're taking it. They visit the clinic three times a day. And we've got about 120 people using it and maintaining on it and actually doing very well on it. And these are people who, with long histories of opioid use, who have failed the more standard methadone treatments.
Could you tell me a little bit about the initiative that you're part of that actually looks at helping to alleviate this problem of producing diacetylmorphine?
Yes, I was approached about a year ago by Dr. Martin Schechter, who's a professor at the School of Public and Population Health at UBC. He was the clinical investigator of the original North American Opiates Medication Initiative, otherwise as NAOMI, which showed that in Canada, we would have as much success with heroin as a maintenance therapy as they do in Switzerland and a number of other European countries. And that was followed up by his Salome trial, which looked at Dilaudid as an alternative to heroin. And he is interested, as am I, in seeing if we can get an affordable, lower-cost domestic supply of diacetylmorphine in Canada. And that is something that we're currently working on, working through the regulatory processes, and looking to see if we can raise sufficient funds to establish a pharmaceutical manufacturing capacity to do that on a low-cost recovery basis.
How receptive have governments been to this, the possibility that this could become regulated at some point, that the company could proceed?
Well, we have to go through the regulatory processes, and there's certainly no barriers being put in the way, but we absolutely have to meet the regulatory requirements. The issue currently, I think, is getting the funding to establish the pharmaceutical manufacturing and do the testing and the work that would need to be done. And that's in the order of $3 million.
It's clearly not cheap. What is the biggest consideration that you think would get governments behind this, would make the case for why something like Dilaudid isn't adequate as a substitute for the long run?
Well, governments don't, very, very rarely do governments get into drug manufacturing themselves. In fact, that's not a role that the state really sees for itself, which is why we, basically it's the pharmaceutical industry produces the drugs, and then the government sometimes subsidizes the purchase of them for people who are eligible. So asking government to fund this is something that would be completely different from the normal processes where you get a manufacturer, he meets the requirements, they produce a product that meets the safety standards, and then it comes to market with a license. So that's what we're currently pursuing.
It's interesting. I wanted to go back to something that you and I talked about in late 2016 after the emergency was declared. We were talking at a mental health conference in Vancouver about why it was that political leaders seemed so resistant resistant to the idea of safe supply outside of, you know, a 100-person clinical study. You said the issue is not would it work, but how would you bring it over? There is evidence that it works, but heroin carries a lot of mythology and a lot of baggage. It wouldn't be politically acceptable. If you're going to launch and expand it, you would have to choose to do it with a drug that has so many blockages, problems, and practical considerations. I wondered, has that culture changed, the political culture, that this is now a conversation? Obviously, drug companies might be hesitant to get into investing in this if they know that many governments are still reluctant to do it.
And in fact, I think you're right. In North America particularly, anybody could apply if they had the funding. A pharmaceutical company could apply, and Health Canada have made that clear, that that individuals, pharmaceutical companies, could apply. I suspect that nobody has, because they're not sure that there's a profitable market in Canada. British Columbia remains the only jurisdiction in Canada that is actually using heroin for this purpose, and we get it under a special license to import it from Switzerland, where it's manufactured. And I think you're right. Looking across the country, even methadone maintenance is controversial in many jurisdictions, certainly very much so in the United States. And I think politically, it is seen as a risky alternative, in that it carries the baggage, and people who don't understand addictions as a chronic relapsing disorder kind of think, oh, geez, you're giving heroin to heroin addicts. Are you crazy? I mean, there are managed alcohol programs, as you're probably aware of, where alcoholics, people who are very dependent on alcohol, can't get off it, are actually given measured amounts of usually wine or beer X number of times a day.
We have our Drinker's Lounge here in the downtown east side that's very popular.
Exactly, yes. And those programs have been examined. They've been thoroughly studied. And people in a program like that do not binge. They do not drink aftershave. They do not end up in the emergency rooms or the jail cells or, you know, the gutters. They actually can manage, and it improves their lot compared with what they were drinking. And you have to recall, I guess, for those of us who aren't alcohol dependent, or even who are but don't have problematic substitutes, there are safe consumption sites. They're called restaurants and bars and lounges, and we have access to a safe supply thanks to the liquor control boards. Because we've criminalized and marginalized and stigmatized substance use and substance dependence, particularly to drugs that are controlled substances that we consider legal, the criminalization really puts this into a whole different perspective, which is challenging for many individuals and challenging for politicians to look at and accept as a medical response to a problem. And then if you move into a safer supply outside of a therapeutic model, where you're not actually trying to get people to stop using drugs, but you're just trying to stop them using drugs that would kill them by presenting them with a non-toxic supply, that is also very controversial, doesn't go well within the medical model. Physicians don't really want to be the gatekeepers to that. And physicians who have developed addictions experience, many of them really want to get a cure or recovery, and they are quite uncomfortable sort of prescribing outside of that rather, you know, medicalized model.
I wondered if you had any reflections on, do you think that perhaps this pandemic has elevated public health officials to the point in people's minds that maybe they will start listening to them on this issue, like they're listening to them on COVID guidelines?
That's an interesting hypothesis. I think we'll have to wait and see. It would be my hope that if we're credible in one area, we'll be credible in other areas. But I think that it does remain to be seen. My sense is that COVID is seen quite differently to substance use disorder or problematic substance use, or even non-problematic substance use, in that COVID is seen as something that can happen to absolutely anybody, irrespective of what they do. Not that that's necessarily true, but that addiction is somehow seen as a behavior of choice or lack of willpower, and certainly stigmatized.
Certainly with COVID, if one chooses to not socially distance or not wear a mask, one could say that's your choice as well.
Exactly, which is why I sort of put a caveat around that. And particularly recently, where we've seen increases in infection in a younger cohort who themselves do not suffer too much from COVID. I mean, the risk of serious illness or death is really quite small in people in their 20s and 30s, but they are a conduit to people who are older or have underlying conditions who will suffer from it.
I wanted to ask you then about Dr. Henry, your successor as the Chief Provincial Medical Officer and also your deputy while you were there. What do you think is she's thinking about at this time, coming into almost 8 months of this pandemic? I guess in a way you dodged the bullet by leaving when you did and left it to her.
I think she's doing a brilliant job. I think it's a very stressful job. I think she's had very few days off since this started. But as I say, I think she's doing a very, very, very good job in a very complex arena. And this is something that I know because we've discussed it. COVID is something that's going to be with us for quite a while. Even when we get a vaccine, it's liable to be less than, fully effective. It will probably require several doses. And as you might recall with the H1N1 vaccine, there are challenges with production. There are challenges with rolling it out. You don't get enough to vaccinate everybody. So you have the whole issue of who goes first and who's second. Then you have vaccine hesitancy. And this is going to be a challenge, I think, for society as a whole, and particularly for the public health folk who are trying to give the best information they can to people who have to make economic decisions, social decisions, decisions affecting parents, families, work, etc. And it's had a huge impact on society, as I'm sure you know. Significant numbers of people have lost incomes and are reliant on emergency funding. It's completely changed the way we do work. It's changed our social scene, and it's had a big impact on the mental health, I think, of the population as well.
Do you think people understand better how public health works? I mean, one of the things that I see often is people saying, well, if I can go to a restaurant, why can't I go to this other thing? And I know that the guidelines are, I understand, developed based on get the most maximum effectiveness across a broad population for the results you get. That's not exactly how most of us think, but it seems to be something within health thinking that's, well, how do you get the most people to get the most effective outcome?
Yeah, and what's the kind of balance? So how do you get the best outcome without having too much in the way of unintended consequences? So it's a balancing. If we shut down society entirely, as was done in a number of European countries, and as we came close to doing in BC, then you can wipe out the infection. But on the other hand, you wipe out most social interactions and the whole basis of the economy, and that has a disastrous impact, which, depending on the severity of the COVID, is arguably at least as bad as COVID on the society. So it's a balance, and I don't think any of us are used to thinking in those terms. We've actually, if you think about it, we live in one of the more privileged parts of the world. We're privileged to be here. What COVID has shown us is that we're not a totally egalitarian society. There have been chasms and growing splits in inequality and in inequity, and we've actually seen those splits widened seriously, severely by COVID and its impact on the economy and how we've responded to it.
Anything that last words about how you see the future?
I'm hoping that because we've seen these unintended consequences, because we've seen the divisions that have been widened, that we can actually, when we come through this together as a society, paying attention to the inequalities and those people who have actually suffered on behalf of the people who haven't suffered, that we might come through this as a better educated, more coherent society, caring more about the people who are less privileged. And then going back to drug policy, I'm hoping that we can have a really sensible discussion around drug policy and come up with a much better, less coercive, less intrusive, more health-oriented way of managing society's relationship with psychoactive substances. So I'd like to see us have a much more rational, health-based approach to currently illegal drugs. And I'd like to see us have a more rational approach to a drug like alcohol, which is deeply embedded in our society, but actually, when you look at it overall, causes more harm probably at current levels of consumption, which in the way are going up, than illicit drugs do. It's just that it happens more slowly over time to an older population.
Mm. Thank you so much for your time, Dr. Kendall. Wonderful to talk to you again.
Thank you for your interest.
Thank you so much. You'll stay healthy. Bye-bye. Dr. Perry Kendall is the interim co-executive director of the BC Center on Substance Use. He's also involved in FPP Inc. or Fair Price Pharma with Dr. Martin Schechter, a researcher on heroin-assisted treatment. Dr. Kendall was the provincial health officer of BC until being replaced by Dr. Bonnie Henry, his deputy, in 2018.
CFRO The Pulse is brought to you by the Local Journalism Initiative, a program funded by Heritage Canada and administered through the Community Radio Fund of Canada.